There are seats reserved for the former Appropriations Committee staff in the front.
I guess we've got to turn these things on.
Yeah, it's a green one. You need help, Ray?
Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for coming. I'm delighted to have you here. This is a real privilege for me personally. I've known both Chairman Visklosky, and I'll say Chairman Hobson because he was chairman for an awful long time when I was in government. Welcome them here to CSIS. As you know, they are both on the leadership of the Energy and Water Subcommittee, and it's hard to think of another subcommittee that's more in the crosshairs. Is that the right way to say it right now? More in the crosshairs, I think, for everything political in the United States right now than energy and water. So we're delighted that they would join us today, take the time and be with us today. Let me just, if I may, just say a word. I'm on a personal campaign to redeem the word politician as a positive word in American society. And let me just say a minute about this. You know, there are only three ways that societies make decisions. One is in the marketplace, you know, where you put a price on a product and people decide they either want to produce it for that or buy it for that. And so through a market mechanism. The second is through administrative methods, you know, where you establish a legal framework and an administrative structure, and you make decisions if something fits appropriately or inappropriately within that structure. And the third way, and it's the only other way, is through politics. You know, and politics is a very important and very good and essential dimension of society. Successful countries really depend on excellent politics, excellent politicians. And we've kind of lost that dimension. Now, these are two of the finest politicians that we have in the Congress. And I've had the privilege of watching, sometimes a little more closely than I wanted to be. A couple of times I felt the heat of their views. But it was always an appropriate interaction, even when it was painful. And that's what politics is about. Politics is about them representing the American people. Politics, the derivative, of course, is the Greek word polis, or people. And they are the representatives of those people, and they are here in town to do that work, making a set of decisions that cannot be made any other way.
What time is
and so we need very what good time? Politicians in America.
Oh,
and I'm very glad to say we've got
we
two of the
be
best
over
here
by
today.
Then.
I want to thank you both for coming. It is a real privilege to have you here. Ray, I'm going to turn it over to you for the substance of this session. And I want to say thank you to all of you. Of course, this is going to be a very dynamic morning because of the topic. I mean, as I said, nothing is hotter and more vibrant right now for the American public than energy. So thank you for taking the time. Ray, take it over.
Thank you, John, very much. I'm Ray Dubois. I'm a senior advisor here at CSIS. But more importantly, as John indicated in terms of his own defense career, I have served in the Defense Department and had to testify many times in front of the Military Construction Subcommittee of the House Appropriations Committee, when the gentleman on my right, Dave Hobson of Ohio, was chairman. I'll talk a little bit about each of these men, and we'll move immediately to their presentations. Each gets about 10 to 15 minutes. As John Hamry said, there are few issues before the nation today in this presidential campaign that are not touched by the Energy and Water Subcommittee. Both of these men also serve on the Defense Subcommittee, and only the Defense Subcommittee, I think, has a larger monetary contribution to the appropriations process. But this subcommittee, the Energy and Water Subcommittee, touches on not just one department, the Department of Energy, obviously, but it also touches upon the nuclear weapons program for the Defense Department. It touches upon the Bureau of Land Reclamation for the Interior Department. And it also deals with the United States Army Corps of Engineers Civil Works Project. So it is a broad portfolio, and one that, as we all know, touches on some of the crucial issues of the day. Pete Visklosky, 12th term member of the House from Indiana, from the 1st District, has Gary in it. Should come as no surprise. He's also chairman of the Steel Caucus of the House. And as I said, also a senior member of the Defense Subcommittee. Dave Hobson, 9th term, 7th Congressional District, the band under Columbus. He's got some Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and other major military installations in his district. These two men have swapped places, as John Hamry addressed them, and appropriately, chairman and ranking member. This is a team that truly reflects, in my judgment, what bipartisanship is all about. That doesn't mean to say that there haven't been partisan moments between these two men and between the two parties, as is the case in a constructive democracy. The Energy and Water Subcommittee marked a bill recently that is in excess of the president's budget submission by $2.1 billion. There are several key areas that I think both of these men will touch upon, and should they not, I'm sure their members of the audience have a list of questions, and we will turn to the audience after they finish. Mr. Chairman, I turn it to you.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the kind comments you made, as well as John. John has been on David and myself for some years to attend a session, and it is my pleasure to be able to do so at the Center for the first time with my good friend and partner, Dave Hobson. Much has been made about our bipartisan relationship, but if you heard the word Columbus, Ohio in the introduction, what we really had to overcome is the fact that Dave Hobson is an Ohio State person. I am a Notre Dame person. And that has at times been much more straining as far as our getting along than anything political. But having also disclosed the fact that I went to the University of Notre Dame, it would be my assumption in this audience that there are a fair number of graduates of the United States Naval Academy. And I want to congratulate each one of you on your victory over Notre Dame in the football game last year. Listen, it's only the first of what I think could be many victories by the Naval Academy over Notre Dame in the future years. Having said that, as I think everybody in the room understands, the committee that Dave and I serve on, and we have essentially had a partnership now for 6 years, is very expansive. And while people are very concerned about the price of energy and energy policy, whether the national security implications, environmental or economic, I think, again, most people here understand that that's a very small slice of the pie, given the water responsibilities we have that are referenced, the Office of Science, and then the weapons program. What I'd like to do is to touch upon the weapons program for a period of time and then turn it over to Dave. The fact is there are some $7 to $8 billion that are dedicated to the issue of our weapons complex, as well as the issue of nonproliferation. That's setting aside the dollars that are expended of our tax monies as far as the environmental management program, the cleanup of the legacy of the beginning and construction of that weapons complex. It is no secret that there is a difference of opinion between the United States Congress and the administration as far as the future of the weapons program, particularly as it relates to the RRW proposal that was put forth by the president several years ago, and the ramifications as far as what the complex should look like. The fact is, we do have probably the ultimate responsibility, and it is of great value that Dave and I serve on the Defense Subcommittee as well as the Energy Committee, so we see both the, if you would, consumer as well as the producer of these systems, is to make sure that for those nation states that we have a concern about, we have deterrence. And for those who would do us harm as far as using a weapon or nuclear materials who are not represented by a nation state, to make sure that we can stop them from doing so. And essentially, when I look at that budget, and I don't mean to oversimplify the issue, the weapons program obviously deals with deterrence. If you look at the nonproliferation program, and again, these are not exclusive programs, by and large, you're looking to stop those who would do us immeasurable harm in a horrific act of terrorism. And I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I'd ask each of you to ask yourself, what is the more likely and possible scenario? And then when you look at the budget of the United States government and recognize as far as the submission for 09, there is 5 times more dollars set aside for the weapons complex than nonproliferation, that we ought to be looking at that. The administration early on had a proposal for the bunker buster. Mr. Hobson was chairman of the committee at that time, and I was the ranking member. That was not funded. The proposal now with the administration is for the RRW. The position we have taken is that we need a strategy for the post-Cold War. We need a strategy so then we know what the number and types of weapons should be to meet that strategy. And once that determination is made, then what type of complex do we need to support that particular strategy? And you had the American Association for the Advancement of Science in April of last year talk about making sure that we would have a bipartisan strategy put into place, one that could outlive any particular administration. It shouldn't be a Bush proposal any more than it should be a McCain or an Obama proposal. It should be a national proposal that multiple administrations and potentially a dozen Congresses can live with, understanding that world situations change daily and that you have to maintain flexibility, but you ought to have a strategy. And a strategy not just as far as those nuclear weapons themselves, but also how do conventional weapons and conventional forces play into that issue of deterrence and stopping people who want to hurt us and do great harm, as well as non-kinetic issues that also ought to be part and parcel of that strategy. Myself, and I now speak only for myself, am not satisfied that there is that type of strategy that has been developed by either the Clinton administration or the Bush administration. And until you do have that, we ought not to proceed in constructing a new weapon. I must also tell you that I'm also very concerned about simply proceeding with what I would call a build in place. That is, if you would proceed with a new weapon, absent a strategy, and setting that argument aside for a second, you have a complex that is under transformation. It is going to be smaller, just as it is smaller today than it was 10 and 15 years ago. But I'm also very concerned with the Department of Energy's track record as far as contract management of major construction projects, that if we allow a new system to be begun in the current complex, one, from a political standpoint, to be very frank about it, you create a new constituency. And secondly, you further complex the ultimate rationalization of the complex as it exists today. So I do think it is our responsibility to continue to bring, if you would, financial pressure on the administration to make sure that they have a strategy in place that we as Americans know serves our purpose as far as the issue of deterrence as well as nonproliferation. Is certainly one of the reasons why in the House mark you saw a reduction in the weapons side of about 7% and an increase in nonproliferation by about 18%. So that ratio I mentioned earlier in my remarks is more like 4-1 weapons versus nonproliferation as opposed to 5-1. I would simply close at this point by indicating that I have a tremendous amount of respect for the people who work, who manage, and who make decisions at NNSA. I think Tom D'Agostino is a very good person, is possessed of a fine intellect, and is doing his very best for this country. I think that pertains to everyone at the complex. We obviously, as sometime David and I have a disagreement on this particular issue, That doesn't mean necessarily he's all wrong or I'm necessarily all right, and would certainly acknowledge that there has been progress made. If you remember, it was about a year and a half ago that the proposal as far as what the rationalization of the complex should be was called 2030. And, of course, the RRW was to come online in about 2012, and my point is we ought to have the same urgency on both sides of the equation. And with the most recent modernization program that has been put forth, that time has now been compressed to 2017. They have also provided a report as to how they want to get to that 2012 timetable under the Moscow Treaty. So again, it is not as though somebody has, from my perspective, stonewalled on the issue, done nothing, or acted irresponsibly. But absent that overarching, nonpartisan strategy that would dictate the weapon systems and then ultimately the complex, people work very hard for the taxes they send to all of us in Washington, D.C., and we ought to be very careful before we proceed down that road. But with that, I would conclude and obviously suggest any issues you have a question about on the committee, whether it's on weapons or anything Dave might touch on, or others. I'd certainly be happy to take those questions, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For those of you who haven't dealt with Pete Visklosky, I think you can now understand that we, citizens of this country, are very fortunate to have someone as knowledgeable and thoughtful in this regard, something as important as nuclear weapons and nonproliferation. Before I turn to Dave Hobson, I just want to take a moment of personal privilege, if I might. He and I worked very hard on improving housing for our military families, both in this country and overseas. And I will tell you, when I joined the Pentagon in early 01, that was an issue, while started by President Clinton and Secretary Cohen, was something that, shall we say, had not gained full traction. And in no small measure because members of the House and the Senate wanted to know more about it. Was it going to be successful? Was this really a private enterprise, private venture, or was the taxpayer ultimately on the hook? Dave Hobson was crucial in negotiating with the executive branch and the military for a successful launch or relaunch, if you will, of the Military Family Housing Privatization Program. And I want to say on behalf of all the soldiers and airmen and Marines and naval personnel and Coast Guardsmen, thank you very much for what you did.
Yeah, thank you.
I have testified, as I indicated, in front of the Military Construction Subcommittee numerous occasions, and it's always been, for me personally and professionally, not as so many hearings are, theater, but substance. Thank you again.
Okay. Thank you, Ray. It's nice to be with you today, and I would have to say that John Hamry has been a hero of mine, even when he used to come to my office and tell me no on some things years ago. But he was always very helpful to us. He didn't always say no. And Ray, you've been a delight to work with over the years. I do take certain pride in what we've done for the housing for our troops, if you look across the country. And that was with the full support of the committee as a whole. And I see many of the committee staff here today from the past. And I want to tell you what a pleasure it's been to serve both in the majority and the minority with the chairman. He's a true professional and he's a true friend. And frankly, we've never had a crossword or a partisan word in the 6 years or as long as I've been on the Defense Committee. That's a tradition of the Defense Committee, and I think it's been a tradition of energy and water, certainly since we've been there together, that we work together on these issues. And I agree with everything he said, so maybe I ought to just stop there, because we do agree. But I think I want to reinforce some of the things he said, and I want to talk a little bit about, hopefully we'll have time to talk about an issue that we haven't really talked about relating to weapons, and that is security and nuclear power and generation of power in general and how it relates back to the security types of things that we've been talking about. But we do need a strategy. We don't really have a strategy. We need a strategy on our stockpile. And we just can't continue to go blindly into these things as we seem to be doing. I differ slightly on our RW because I would keep it open. I would keep the light on open on the door. I wouldn't fund it. I agree with what we did. We're not ready yet. And frankly, we need the administration, whatever the administration is, and the Congress to come together. We've got the, in doing RRW, we've got the cart before the horse, and so we just need to rethink that. But I wouldn't shut the door. We are, as Pete talked about, in a Cold War mode when it comes to our weapons complexes. And some years ago, we jointly asked the department's group, they had a review panel, to Spence Abraham, I think, was the secretary. Then we challenged them to have a report on what the weapons complex should look like. Not a thought, you know, you'd think the agency was doing itself, but they weren't. So we asked for that. Guess what? We got a report. It's called the Oversky Report. It's online. You can all read it. I wish the department had read it a little better, because not only did they just dismiss it, they dismissed the group, the advisory group. They just disbanded the advisory group and went on their merry way in continuing. And what we really need, do we need three weapons labs? I don't know, but somebody ought to be looking at it. Do we still need this production spread around the country? And there's another thing happening. The labs now want to, the NNSA labs now want to get into other work. The question is, what kind of work? How are they going to compete with the other labs? How are the universities and other places in the country going to be in competitive mode with these national labs? And it's all about preservation of status quo and jobs. And nobody really wants to get into that particular conflict from a political standpoint. But it needs some leadership, and it needs to be done. We tried to do that, but it didn't happen. We spend $1.5 billion on nuclear nonproliferation. I wonder sometimes if we really are spending it in the right way. What is our plan? There's sometimes it just seems like somebody comes along with this idea here and this idea there. And what kind of results are we getting? You know, hospitals go through a thing where they look at their results and they have a study of their results. I think we need to have a study of our results, of our non-results, and say, are we putting our money in the right place? We need a roadmap on non-proliferation money. And if you want to look at something, and I'm not going to get into the thing that everybody expects me to talk about for a long time, and that's the mixed oxide fuel debacle. And I hear people laughing. They know I rant rave about that. But I would just suggest to you that you all look at it and see if it's worth $11 billion of non-proliferation money. Just look at it. If you think that's the way we ought to go, fine. I think it's a jobs program, and you've all heard that before. The thing I really wanted to talk about a little bit is the problem between civilian nuclear power and the weapons work. There is a linkage between the peaceful purposes for nuclear energy and weapons purposes. We talk about proliferation in the nuclear weapons area, but we tend not to look at the problems in the world with proliferation from using nuclear fuel in power reactors around the world. And you can see a lot of things happening in that. But there are certain things that are inherent in this that we need to remember. About 50% of our base load comes from coal. About 20% comes from nuclear, and about 9.1 comes from of our electricity comes from hydro. That is a scenario that I don't think we can continue. And we're trying to solve two problems. We're trying to get rid of our dependence on foreign oil, and we're trying to solve our problem with greenhouse gases. We need a program that works through that. And frankly, I don't think we have that right now. And there's a lot of bad actors in the world out there that we're not considering. The administration is out there on this GNEP proposal. I think that's a risky program out there to do, because at the same time, we're giving all this advanced reactor technology to the foreign countries. We're not controlling the fuel. Now, Mr. Lantos and myself put up a bill. It was his bill. It passed the House. It's for an international fuel bank run by the IEA, not the United States. But we passed that bill, and we not only did that, we did something that's a no-no in the appropriations process. We legislated on an appropriations bill. And it went through. And there's $50 million out there to implement this plan. But the IEA is not really maneuvering in it, nor is our government picking up on this, although they were supportive as we went through this. So I'd like to see more people get involved in a total program of how we control the world, and the world controls itself through the UN in the fuel process. No politics in this. There doesn't need to be politics in it if the fuel bank is run correctly. So I would like to encourage people to look at the bill, look at how we might implement that and do it in a peaceful way. The other thing, there's a lot of stovepiping that goes on. Let me give you an example of how we don't think correctly across agencies when we're doing this. And one of the great things is that Pete and I sit on the Defense Appropriations Committee as well as the Energy and Water Committee. So I see the Air Force, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, naturally in my district, starting on a synthetic fuel program. So they start out, and they're using a process that was developed in the 30s by the Germans, Fischer-Tropsch, and it's dirty, but they're worried about their security and being held hostage by some foreign oil sources, so they're out looking for things to do. Well, I think, gee, wouldn't it be nice if the Department of Energy and the Air Force worked together on this program? So we bring people together, and they kind of looked at each other and went, duh. And then each went back to their own little stovepipe and went about their business. So we're out there developing a Fischer-Tropsch engine in the Air Force. And a whole process for that, and they say they can clean it up a little bit, but it's still not the right way to go. We need better technology. We need Department of Energy and them working together, because we're working across purposes. We're spending the wrong monies, maybe in the wrong places, and we need to really, really look at that. I think you've understood the challenge from what the chairman talked about our bill. This is a very diverse bill. You know, we have competing varieties of things that we have to work on. You know, nuclear weapons, nonproliferation, water and infrastructure by the Corps of Engineers, the Bureau of Reclamation, basic science research, and which I happen to think is the future of this country, applied energy research by DOE, and finally, environmental cleanup. And frankly, environmental cleanup is just a complete mess. It costs way too much, and we never seem to get anything done on time. It was some, but the major projects, go look at Hanford, it'll make you sick, and the monies that are spent out there. But I'm hoping that in the future, the chairman, I won't be there, I'm retiring, but I'm hoping that in the future, the chairman here and the chairman in the Senate can come together in some ways to work through these problems we've talked about here. I'm hoping that the next administration will work together to come up with a total plan that we can work through, not only the nuclear weapons complex, not only the energy situation, but the water and those developments. We can't continue these disasters the way we're funding them and doing them. That's part of our charge, too, is how do we prepare the waterways? There's no planning. We tried to get five-year development plans. We got pushback from OMB on five-year development plans. Nobody runs a business. Yeah, you laugh. I mean, you think, gee, these guys ought to be thinking about what they're going to do the next 5 years. They don't think that. They think, what are we going to get in the next bill? Where are we going to go in the next bill? This country, when it comes to energy, when it comes to nuclear weapons and proliferation, we need plans. We need long-range plans and goals. They can change along the way, but we need to be passionate about planning and where we're going to go. We found out that this reliance on fossil fuels is not a good thing. We've got to get to not only nuclear power, but it has to be a blend. It can't be all nuclear power. I know that's not the answer. It is a partial, it's part of a package. We have to have renewables, but we all have to work together. We have to have a plan. Right now, it's hit or miss. So with that, I'm going to stop and say it's been a pleasure for these 6 years for us to work together, I think. We have never, as I said before, We have never had a disagreement. I've had wonderful staff. Colonel Kraft, you all know back there. I call him Kenny. But Kenny's been with me almost all the time. I've been on appropriations. And Kevin Cook was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. Tanya's probably the best thing today that's happened to the committee. She's now the clerk, and she started as with the Corps of Engineers detailee, and now she's the clerk, first woman clerk, I think, ever of energy and water. So we've just had, and Rob Blair's going to be the guy who, in the future, if you have to go yell at somebody, go talk to Rob, because he's taken over for Kevin. But it's been a wonderful time for me to learn. I came to this committee, and I had never been in the room before when I became chairman. What a great way to become chairman. Huh. I walked into the room, and I was chairman. And I had to learn a lot. I learned a lot from Pete. I learned a lot from the staff. And I thank Jim Dyer for the staff and for helping me to learn about this issue. And I became obsessed by what's going on here, because the future of our country is in science and technology. And it's in this committee, and it's under this wonderful gentleman's leadership. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Ray, if I could, just... I just want to make a note here. Dave talked about walking in the first day he was chairman. It took me 22 years. So that gives you a sense of perspective. And on a personal note, too, and I've said it before, full committee, my mentor, who was a member of the Appropriations Committee as a freshman and chaired two different subcommittees, turned me into, if you would, an appropriator at heart. But the person who taught me how to be a chairman and the mistakes I make are my own is the gentleman to my right, Mr. Hobson, my chairman.
Thank you, Pete.
The reason we're here today is because when Congressman Hobson announced his retirement, I think I was in his office the next day, revealing my party affiliation. I tried to talk him out of that. Sure, a 10th term doesn't sound good?
No?
Okay.
It's too late.
We'll move right into questions. As you know, both of these gentlemen, by virtue of what they have said today and in the past, have, and in terms of the mark this year, put renewed focus on renewable energy and efficiency programs. Having said that, there is, in this presidential year, obviously a tremendous focus on economics, on environmental issues, and on energy. The House and Senate and the two presidential candidates have been going back and forth on drill, don't drill, more efficiency, more conservation, and so forth. I'd like to hear, if I'll take the prerogative of the chair and ask the first question, I'd like to hear from both of these gentlemen on the issues of energy conservation, not necessarily versus energy exploration, but how they go together. And I'm reminded when I picked up the paper this morning that yesterday the United States Geological Survey had a press conference and revealed the results of a four-year study that said the Arctic may contain, and I quote from the article, the Arctic may contain as much as a fifth of the world's yet-to-be-discovered oil and natural gas reserves. There is, as everyone in this room knows, you know, an ongoing debate, drill or don't drill, in that particular part of the globe. So, Mr. Chairman, perhaps you'd like to give your views on that broad subject?
I would. I guess the first observation I would make on the issue of drilling is that it is a gross oversimplification of the problems we face, because the problems we face are economic, that cost of energy, and it is killing people in the United States of America. It is a huge national security issue, given where we get about 70% of our oil. So to the extent you could drill or produce more in the United States of America, obviously that is part of the solution. We have a third aspect of this, though, and that is also the environment. And we have to move our economy away from being carbon-based. The other thing that upsets me about this is that it has turned the energy debate into a very partisan issue. That is, generally, and it's not exclusive, but if you're a member of the Republican Party, you're for drilling. If you're a member of the Democratic Party, you're supposed to be opposed to drilling. And but for drilling, we would solve all of our problems. My personal perspective is I have supported drilling for natural gas. I have opposed opening up ANWR. And my point would be that we could drill ourselves crazy, and we're using 23% of the oil in this world, and we have about 2 or 3% of the reserves, and let's say double it because of the Arctic, and okay, we got 6%. We're still behind the curve. I think from a political standpoint, to be very frank about it, we ought to have a vote in the House of Representatives about it. And just let everybody have a debate about this issue, and let's have a vote, and let's see what happens. And then let's see if there's ever a vote in the United States Senate.
Congressman Hobson, you...
You didn't get that at all, did you? One person left.
You mean about the Senate?
Yes, sir. Okay. Okay.
Several days ago, Congressman Hobson issued a press release and said, the clock is ticking, the time is the act now, referring to the, quote, Drill Responsibly in Leased Lands Act of 2008, H.R. 6515, which was proposed by the majority but opposed by both environmental and small business groups. Now, Mr. Hobson, would you like to comment on your sort of charge as you retire, you're walking out the door, you're telling your colleagues, come on, get with the program, let's get a bill here that makes sense?
Well, I think the last part is the most important part. Let's get a bill here that makes sense. I think you're correct. We can't drill our way out of this problem. We can have a balance of things that we need to work for. Well, I'm old enough to remember 1970. And in 1970, about the time we started to do some good things, the spigot got turned on overseas, and gasoline prices came down after I bought my diesel Oldsmobile. They don't make them anymore either, and they weren't that good. But I tried it, and I bought a diesel Rabbit, and we did all the things, and we were given credits, and all of a sudden it went away as soon as we started to think about some things. I think hopefully the public's got the message. Fossil fuels we need to lessen our dependence on by whatever means we can do responsibly and environmentally. I think we need to send a message in the interim to work through this that we are serious about drilling. I'm not sure that I would drill an ANWR. I think ANWR itself has become such a cause celebrité that doing that would destroy any other drilling that you might do responsibly. I might say, when you talk about drilling responsibly, as far as I know, we lost in Kachina, we lost the use of some wells, but there were no spills as a result of that. So I think we can drill better today than we used to and more responsibly with the environment. But I agree that it's only one part of the equation. And everybody in politics tends to look, unfortunately, for the easy, short-term soundbite in these things. But at the same time we do that, we need to press everybody to be more environmentally concerned about even small things. I mean, I'm changing my light bulbs. I don't like the fact they're made in China, but I'm changing the light bulbs as we go through our house. We're changing how we do things. I'm turning out the lights. My kids look at me kind of crazy. They're older, and I'm trying to teach them and their kids to start turning out. My dad used to do that, and I thought he was crazy, but he wasn't. And we need to start doing things more responsibly. And I think you're seeing the public start to do that. The cost of gas is so high now that they're starting to change. But everybody's looking for a quick little fix. There is no quick little fix to that. This is going to take years to do responsibly, and it's going to be a combination. You know, T. Boone Pickens has got a thing out here on wind. Wind is not the total answer, but it's the fastest growing part, and we need to responsibly move into that. I don't want to make a whole bunch more billionaires by getting into wind and the subsidies that are in wind. If wind's that good, why do we have to do all these subsidies? Solar we should be into. You know, isn't it crazy? Your water heater is one of your, you're getting all my stuff here, but One of the most inefficient things in your house is your water heater. You ought to be able to go to Walmart or Lowe's or Home Depot and get a fix for it. We ought to be doing more houses geothermal. I had a geothermal house 14 years ago. It works even better today. We should have building codes that if you're going to build a new house, it ought to have the right R factor and the right windows in it. And gradually, we would move to a better use and be more environmentally friendly. One of the things that none of you have talked about, you all talk about nuclear and everything, water is going to become a huge problem in this country. Huge problem. Now we have too much or too little, wherever it is. And people haven't taken advantage of it. If I ask all of you in here where is the most difficult water problem in the United States, you would be all over and you wouldn't pick the right one except somebody finally wrote about it. It's Atlanta. It's the most difficult place to fix. They haven't done, in my opinion, they didn't do any preparation for drought. And now there's continued to be this fight between Florida and Alabama. Water is going to be a problem. Oil is a problem. We are a problem, both as individual citizens and the government. And we don't have any real plans. But drilling, Ray, is only a part of it. I would drill in certain areas to send a message to the speculators and other people, not that we're going to drill out of this, but that we're going to do something, and that we're going to move in that small way, and that'll give us some time to move in these other things. But what worries me, as soon as we pass a drilling bill, if we passed one and the Senate would do it, that everybody will walk away from all the things we need to do in our society. This is a change time in our society, and we need to be, as citizens, talking to us about and changing us as well as you in the way we live today. And I don't see people talking about those real choices. But if we don't, my grandchildren are in trouble, and I'm worried about that.
I would just add two quick points. One, we had an oversight hearing last year before we began our series of hearings, and I wouldn't want you to lose the word conservation in what we've talked about, and Dave touched upon it. The largest savings, if you would, or the greatest amount of progress we've made since 1977 has been on conservation, and if we continue in that vein in a balanced, multifaceted program, we're light years ahead because you don't have to find that BTU. Relative to drilling, don't forget you also have the Strategic Petroleum Reserve that is under the jurisdiction of this subcommittee. And during the last 2 years, as some of you may know, the administration has proposed increasing the size. In both years, the committee and last year the Congress said no on the theory that we have enough problems as far as price right now without placing the federal government in as a further competitor.
The quick fix comments. Notwithstanding some members of my party in this town, conservation, the reduction of energy per unit of output in the manufacturing community is, quite frankly, the most immediate way to reduce demand and reduce price. But I'll stop there and turn to the audience. Please identify yourself and concise questions only. Let's see.
Energy Conversation, which is funded by DOD. We're now well into our third year to educate everybody about all of these various aspects about energy. My question for you, Mr. Hobson, is how do you get people to think beyond the first order solution? I think of the world in terms of context, cause, choices, and consequences. We don't teach kids to play chess, but if you play chess, you think about what's the third or fourth order move. And most political choices are made as a one-off solution. If you started talking about we had to think in those terms, I mean, you're all leaders. Your job is to sort of educate a broader group to start thinking this way. And I do think it has to go back to the elementary schools, but we still have all those folks that need to be educated. How do you get Congress to start thinking about if we make this choice, what are the second and third order consequences?
Thanks, Betsy.
Well, I've been here 18 years, and it is Congress reacts to pressures that it receives from mainly individuals. I know you think it's all special interest groups and things of that sort, but really when you go home and you listen to your constituents and they start talking about things is when you really respond. And I think it is a teaching thing. And when I don't tell it any differently when I'm home than I try to here. And I think Congress needs to feel, and people need to feel, and they're feeling now. They're hurting. People are hurting now. They're more willing to accept some change now in a broader sense than I think they were a year ago or 2 years ago, or certainly when I came here. We have had the luxury of low energy costs historically in the world that have funded our economic well-being. That day is over. Not everybody has recognized that yet. But we need to start educating in the schools. I mean, we did this in smoking. We haven't solved all the smoking, but it's a lot down than it was before. I can remember my kids came home and they were writing little notes to their mother about smoking and writing in the car. Well, I'm going to get hurt for that if she hears this. But anyway, it worked. It worked. And my wife hasn't smoked for probably 25 years. And in schools today, my grandkids today don't do it. Kids, young people today, many of them are more environmentally conscious than we were. We took it for granted. We can't take this for granted. So it's an educational program. Members have to be educated. Caucuses have to be educated. And the media has to educate. There's some articles beginning to come out, but what I worry about is that everybody's looking for a quick fix, whether it be whatever it is, and it isn't, whether it's drilling or whatever, and it isn't there. It's all part of a package. But I do think in the short run, we have to send some sort of message to the speculators that they can't keep driving these prices up through the speculation on the futures and things of this sort. And while the drilling is way out, it's going to take them a while to get to any of this stuff. It does send a message, but it's got to be with other things. I think if I were the other party at this point, I'd come up with a comprehensive bill that had some limited areas to drill in and then get the conservation things that they want, because the public is, that's about where the public, I think, is today. You know, we always get stuck with, either I get stuck with the guys way to the right, he gets stuck with the guys way to the left. We're kind of caught in between. That's where the public is, caught in between, and they need us to respond responsibly. And frankly, neither side right now, in my opinion, is responding in the fashion as to where the public is.
Thank you, Dave. Question? Back here in the blue shirt.
Hi, as you mentioned...
Would you identify yourself, please?
Oh, Lee Patrick Sullivan with Clean Skies TV News. You had mentioned about in the 70s the spigot was turned back on to lower prices, and we are dealing with a cartel in OPEC. Is there any plans for new legislation to have some sort of mechanism that is, for lack of a better phrase, no turning back, that we are going for renewables, that regardless if oil drops down to $9 a barrel, we're not stopping, we're going forward? Because if we are addicted to foreign oil, as many people have said, if the drug becomes cheaper, we'll go back to using it. So is there any sort of framework for no turning back?
I'd like both gentlemen to address that.
I would start by saying that you can't legislate emotions, and $4 gasoline makes people angry. It takes a lot of money out of their pocket. It makes them feel poor, and it reduces their standard of living. If we simply pass a bill to say, listen, you shouldn't feel so bad because we're going to do this no matter what, and prices go down hopefully to $2 a gallon, that pressure is going to dissipate. The fact is, in public life, I have always believed that the people you hear from first are those who disagree with you and those who are angry. Our responsibility, and Dave talked about it, is leadership. When I go home and talk about this issue, the first thing I mention, whether it's a service club, whether it's a town forum, is I cannot, no matter what we have done together, and I would say under Dave's chairmanship, we were looking to increase funding that made sense on a broad spectrum, let alone what we've done today is going to bring down that price. because you have control on one side as far as supply, and you have a lot of other factors. Our job is, as he said, is to educate people that no matter what happens with price tomorrow morning, we have to change because of national security issues. 70% of that oil is coming from a place we don't want to send our money to, and we got a carbon problem. So that's our problem. You can't pass a law to that. You have to exercise leadership.
Let me tell you what I would do if I were any of the candidates running today for national office. I think this is a question of national security. I think it has to be in order to solve that particular problem and the energy problem as a whole. And I hate to admit this because I don't want to buy French airplanes, but the French have done it right when it comes to nuclear power. They sold it as, and they're not to be held hostage strategically. They store their fuel much right next door to a daycare school I was at. But they sold it on the basis of security. I think we need to sell our energy policy, not on the price up and down, but it is our national security that's at risk here. It is our quality of life that is riskier if we go back to the ways we were a year ago. And the most responsible politicians, in my opinion, I guess since I'm not running, I can say this, but I think, and when I get out of this job, if I can, I'm going to advocate for responsible policies that, from a security standpoint, we do to protect the quality of life we've come to love in this country and the freedoms we have, because we are going to be held hostage, if we're not already held hostage, by fossil fuels. And we need to take those steps, and leaders, people should vote for leaders that step forward and say, we're not going to go back on this. No matter what the price of oil is, we're going to go forward with a balanced plan of all types of things. But we have to have a plan. And frankly, we don't have a plan today of how to deal with this, other than a little strike here, a little strike there, and a little strike there. And we throw money at things on the wall and hope that they come true in some breakthroughs, like the breakthrough we did at, what's the 3M thing that I always throw out?
Transmission line.
We found a thing that, and we did an earmark, by the way, that helps power lines to do it, and we found it. But we need a plan overall of how we're going to do this stuff, and we don't have that plan. And I don't. Somebody needs to come forward. You know, Boone Pickens is out there with one piece, one frankly expensive piece if you look at it. But over a period of time, it may not if others would get into it. But at least he's doing something. At least he's got something. But there's no, you look at either party. What is the plan? Drill or no drill?
Now, that's
not a plan.
Both of you, in fact, your subcommittee, I think, unanimously recommended that the Generation 4 Nuclear Reactor Initiative, you plussed it up significantly from the presidential budget submission to $200 million, $130 million over what the PBS was. Why did you do that, and what will that accomplish in your view?
It takes the long view. I don't know that the industry, because they're trying to get started again, is necessarily as enamored as Dave and I are with the next generation, because they have to build reactors today. But our position is that we ought to be looking to the future. And if we are also going to wean ourselves from carbon, we're going to have to look at how we power our vehicles and our transportation. And one of the ideas, at least, is hydrogen. And my understanding as an accounting major from Indiana University is you can't just go out and grab it. You have to produce it. And with the high-temperature gas-cooled reactors, you can get a twofer. So all the more reason to start down that road and get going and see if we can do this successfully. And I'm also told from a proliferation standpoint they're safer, and from an operational standpoint they're much safer. So we ought to start that process now and focus people's attention on the next generation while we proceed with the reconstitution of the nuclear industry today.
Okay. Question. Over here, you, sir. Yes. Mike?
Hi, Scott Pugh, Department of Energy, Renewable Energy. I want to make clear I'm not asking this question on the behalf of DOE.
Yes or no?
I am not.
Oh, okay.
This is my personal question. But
the media make note of it.
I think our defense budget right now is about is greater than the combined defense budgets of the next 10 countries in the world. And I also think it's true today that we're spending about twice as much on NASA and space exploration as we're spending on the non-weapons area of DOE. In your view, is it time for us to realign some of that discretionary spending to energy R&D?
We should spend more on energy R&D, and that's exactly what we proposed in 2008 fiscal year, and that's the current year we're in, as well as the committee report for 2009. But we've mentioned a number of times that we both serve on defense. And the fact is, from my perspective, we're not meeting our needs today, given the responsibilities that we have worldwide, and given the fact that we're involved in a number of controversies overseas, including Iraq and the country of Afghanistan, where I don't think we have done enough from the first day, and that costs money. I make it clear I voted against the invasion of Iraq, but as long as we have people there and it is the policy of this country to be there, I want to make sure that our troops are as safe as possible and have the equipment and training they need, and that has been shorted from the first day. So I would not in any way, shape, or form suggest that that is the pot we go to get the money. We ought to have the intestinal fortitude to understand that the long term, you want to talk about the long term in this country and what we need to do in this country is to go after the mandatory programs. I'm an appropriator. I can remember under the Kennedy administration about a third of every dollar we spent was mandatory, and two-thirds we have some discretion and decision-making capacity. And very shortly, we are going to simply be sending out, hopefully, continually, retirement checks. And we have a great burden
yeah,
as far
I hope,
as our health care
system. I hope we do.
Which doesn't leave a lot of room to maneuver. We ought to be figuring out long-term, sooner rather than later, given the joys of compounding if we act today instead of 15 or 20 years from now, how to make room for the necessary investment in this country. Whether it be for energy research, whether it be for sheer infrastructure with bridges collapsing in places like Minnesota.
Yeah. I'm glad you talked on that plan. We need planning. We don't have planning for emergencies. We don't have planning for hardly anything in this country longer than a year or two, if that. I wouldn't just throw things at the wall. We need a plan. We don't have a plan. You don't have a plan in the department, in my opinion, that really solves anything. We just throw money at things. I'll tell you another thing. I asked the Deputy Secretary of Defense about NNSA and who funded NSA and why they didn't fund it. And he said, well, I think we do. Well, for Christ's sake, we don't. And he's a good friend of mine. If NNSA was funded out of the Defense Department, it would be, I won't use the word I was going to use, but it would be a heck of a lot different than it looks today. And there's some savings there. There's a lot of work that would not be done as wasteful as it's done today. You try to change that. I poked at that very hard, and I got poked back hard. So we haven't really poked at that as much as we would have liked to change some things. But think about that. I asked at a defense hearing about NNSA, and they thought they were funding it. That's scary.
Okay. Yes, sir, right here in front.
Thank you. Bill Magwood, Advanced Energy Strategies.
I remember you.
You remember me. Good.
You've lost weight.
I have. Thank you.
Thank you for noticing.
Well, people like me, we'll look at that.
Well, I know we're not here to congratulate this partnership, but I'd like to congratulate this partnership. I've watched, worked with you and watched you since I've left DOE. And I think that the level of intellectual rigor and honesty and the passion that came out of this relationship has been really unique, and I really congratulate you for that. In listening particularly to Chairman Hobson's, and I'll continue to use that title, comments, it seems to me that one issue that is sort of circling around here is not just in terms of DOE, not other things, but in terms of DOE, sort of the continuity of planning. And in my experience, that was always kind of one of the issues. You know, as time went on, I see Kevin over here, he's shaking his head or nodding his head. As time goes on, things just continue to change and evolve, and it's kind of hard to keep things on track for more than a couple of years at a time. Have you given thought, particularly as you're retiring and as you look forward to new administration, have you given thought to whether DOE institutionally is in the right place to continue? Because I've seen this happen even when we had really good people running DOE and not so good people running DOE. It's always been change. And not that change is bad, but when you change every couple of years, it's kind of hard to get things like, you know, Generation 4 reactors or other things to really come to some fruition.
Change in administrations and departments is a given, and I think we have to accommodate that. I think it gets back to, though, Dave's point earlier that if there are reasoned plans in place, understanding that they have to have flexibility attached to them, that world circumstances change every day, domestic circumstances change every day, that if you're kind of on this road from one administration to another, and there has been some bipartisanship and some inclusion as far as the development of this plan and where you want to go, you at least increase your opportunities to be able to do that. I also think, although you now see term limitations as far as chairs in the House, which is inexplicable to me, I must tell you, and not simply because
I agree
I'm
with
chair.
You,
no, I thought that's always caucuses, whether they be Republican or Democrat, have a responsibility to make sure people are capable of meeting their responsibility. But there is an incredible amount of institutional knowledge that this gentleman to my right has taken with him. And I want a guy like that, who knows where those bodies are buried, not maliciously, but just what the deal is, what the systems are, what the culture is. And that's a congressional responsibility. That's our oversight responsibility, that there's always going to be change and people coming and going. But that's at the very top. In the end, you have a huge infrastructure of people that are there permanently. And you would hope that they're imbued with this idea that we ought to at least we may go to the right side of the road or the left side of the road, and I don't say that politically, but let's stay on the road, and maybe we'll have to bend it a little bit, but let's be in this for the longer term. The greatest concern, I must tell you, I have with the Department of Energy, and I mentioned it in my opening remarks, is contract management. They have been on the GAO watch list since 1991. And I tell people, no matter who the new administration is and what their proposals are, I hate to flush money down a toilet. And I brought a list with me, and I'm not going to read it, as far as all of the major construction projects that are over time, over budget, and at some point I understand each one of these is very unique. Each one of these systems is very complicated, but there's no excuse for it any longer. And for one of the top officials for the Department of Energy, when asked about what have you done over the last year to get off of that list since 1991 under Democratic and Republican administrations, to be dismissed as, well, that doesn't really count, that's just GAO. If that attitude that I hope does change with whoever the next administration is, that we should be serious about managing people's money, and it gets back to the gentleman's budgetary issue, maybe we get more bang for our buck if we're not blowing it on contracts.
The contract, let me just say one thing. The contracts are abominable. Just watch Mox before it's over. Look at Hanford. Look at any of these things. They're just outrageous. If you ran your business this way, you'd be embarrassed. But they aren't. I think the other thing that's institutional in this is that for many years, this committee was known as the Water Committee in the House. And it was not known as Energy and Water. And we pushed back on that. And Pete is making sure that the House is still involved in that. I think you have to remember, somebody needs to historically look at how this agency was cobbled together. It doesn't all fit quite correctly. And somebody needs to look, like the NNSA stuff and some other things, there's some reasons in the past for things, but there's some systemic problems within the department that need to be looked at beyond politics. And historically, this is in both parties, mm-hmm. We have not really sought out the best people to run it or to be in certain positions in it to do the right thing, not the political thing, the right thing for this country. That's probably been my biggest frustration since I've been in this job, both when I was chairman and when Pete's chairman, is to make sure that this runs on what's right, not necessarily what's political.
Okay, we're going to take, the members have some hearings and votes that we got to get to.
We're not doing any appropriations bills, so don't worry.
We'll get, all right, in the back, Angus.
Thank you. David Daly, Destinatus Consulting. Question for you both gentlemen, please. Russia and China, I'm drawing this discussion back to the weapons element. Russia and China are charitably not going the way we want them to go. China, uncertainty. Russia, clearly a retrograde. Both have weapons programs that are advanced, that are current, and that are moving forward. Knowing that weapons programs take 10, 20 years to get to fruition, does it concern you, and do you have solutions to address that problem here in the United States? RRW is a study at this point. It's not a program.
Okay, let's cut it there. Question.
Go ahead.
I'll start. Time does matter, and that's why it's important for this administration to initiate people at the State Department, the Department of Defense, the intelligence communities, people at the Department of Energy, and with that transition team to make sure that we have a strategy to meet the threats you clearly enunciate that I would not dispute before we start down that road. Because my grave concern is if there is a penny appropriated for the RRW study as you would characterize it, that's the green light and we don't need a strategy because we've won.
Well, I think you need to keep the light on. I don't want to build any. As far as I understand from the military, we have plenty of weapons. And I don't want to build any new weapons. I want to be sure that the ones we have are reliable, safe, and we can do this without testing. But we need a plan from the administration, and we need the administration to be candid about what's happening. And I don't think we've really had that. And I would be, I've fully supported Pete in the RRW approach simply because when we tried to turn the light on a little bit, they ran to a whole new toy store. And that's not where we need to go in this country. And we were going to frighten the world. And I think this needs to be responsibly thought out and observed. And I'm very concerned that the Russians came in and told us that they weren't going to do the MOX program. They're going to do it in a different way on their own timetable. And yet we still go ahead. We have strange policies. So I support the chairman. I understand the threats. Well, maybe I understand them as well as I've been briefed on the threats, because we don't get totally briefed on the threats. But I've come to be concerned, because usually what happens is the general will tell me what he really thinks as he's retiring. And I don't like that. And I don't think that's responsible. And I can tell you it happened to me on the Bunker Buster. And one of the reasons I became willing to kill it was that I finally got the right information from and confirmed it from more than one source. But there are still people in this country that have never seen a weapon they didn't want to build and field. And that's intolerable to me to do that. So anyway, I've ranted about that.
And I would just add, because it's a very important issue, is there is an impulse, and I wouldn't even suggest it's a conscious thought, but it's an impulse. As I mentioned earlier, the original complex transformation was 2030. We now, because of our interchange, and I would like to think some of the pressure we brought to bear, down to 2017. But as far as the study, they're talking about production much earlier than that. The other thing I think we have to be very cognizant of is our world position. That threat and people who want to be expansive as far as nuclear weaponry and those materials. If we do at some point proceed, and I'm not suggesting that some of the technology as far as use control and surety and things aren't of value with the ROW. But if it is not part of a comprehensive package that we want to have a smaller system that meets all of the threats as far as deterrence and stopping those who would do us harm as part of an overall package, as opposed to we'll do this first and we'll get to everything later, we're also sending a very destabilizing message internationally.
We've gone over our time, but I don't think we can leave this discussion, at least I can't, without asking these two gentlemen, notwithstanding Congressman Hobson's remark that there are no appropriations bills that they have to deal with, are we going to have a defense appropriations bill, or why can't we have a defense appropriations bill?
I'll let Mr. Hobson handle that.
I think there will be a bill before the end of the day. Let me put it this way. I'm hopeful there will be a bill. I'm not sure it will be done in the same order as bills have always been done before. But I'm hoping, and I think Pete hopes, and everybody on that committee wants, I think, to pass the bill. And we need to figure out a way to get it done. But we have, I mean, I said this to the media, and they won't print it. We have two of the finest people leading that committee in the Congress. There are no two people better suited to get a bill done than Jack Murtha and Bill Young. If it can possibly be done, they will find a way to get it done because they work like we do. And I'd like to think we've learned, certainly I've learned from both of them, and I think Pete would say he has too, in how we work. And so at the end of the day, if there's any bill, that one should be done. And in my opinion, the VA, whatever they call it, the new bill
VA
with
Milcon.
VA, Milcon, all everything, THUD, I guess it is, ought to be done. Those two bills, if nothing else is done. Our bill could be done, but I don't think people want to go through on the floor what they have to go through to get it done. But we've got the votes. We had the votes last year to get it done, and we'll override a veto.
Then what's the full committee chairman and the speaker doing?
You'd have to talk. I don't know.
You'll have to invite them to.
Yeah. Okay. That's a whole other world. We can tell you about the two committees we're on. We can't tell you about the rest of the
world. All right. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for coming. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. David, thank you.